Since throughout human history, poets, writers, lyricists, artists have long speculated about ushering in a new age, an age of Aquarius, or something like that, as they share with us their visions of reality, worlds populated by gods, by giants, elves, various magical and mystical beings. And modern humans don't seem to have much time for that sort of thing anymore. The closest we come to is that our interest in what we talk about on this program, aliens, interdimensionals, ultra-terrestrials, time travelers, whatever you want to call them, whatever you perceive them to be. Is it possible we've lost something along the way, lost our connection to the world, certainly to the spirit world, but maybe to the natural world as well? We've got machines and computers and bits and bytes, lots of information, but are we more ignorant than we were in previous ages? Big questions. These are the kinds of issues tackled in the new book, Viral Mythology, an examination of how we share information with our fellow human beings, how ideas spread, and whether the information has affected how we evolved as a species. This is not ancient history we're talking about. It's going on all around us right now, maybe at a faster pace than ever before. The authors of the new book, Viral Mythology, Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman, are my guests for the rest of this program. We welcome them and jump into the conversation right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. And tonight, Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman are both veterans of the paranormal, spiritual studies, metaphysics. They've both done a lot of research over the years, but both are also academics. They both have PhDs. They co-host a radio show on the Live Paranormal Network and are familiar with the kinds of topics that we talk about all the time. They are the co-authors of this new book, Viral Mythology. I read it today, and I'll tell you what, it is really entertaining and informative and fun. And I'm going to be thinking about this. I read it in a hurry to prepare for the program. I'm going to read it again for fun because there's a lot of stuff in there and I want it to sink in. Marie and Larry, welcome to the program.
That's great to be on.
Hey, George, thanks for having us.
Let's start it this way. Why don't each of you take a shot at giving me sort of a thumbnail sketch of the theme of the book and what you want to convey? Marie, why don't we start with you?
Sounds good, but I do want to clear up that neither Larry or I have a PhD.
Oh, I read that in, where did I read this? Where
I
did I
don't
read this?
know. But we act like we do. No,
Oh, okay. I've just bestowed upon you PhD,
I don't
so.
want anybody going PhD,
Wow.
but we do a lot of research. We're
Okay.
good at it. So, but anyway, I think this came about. Larry and I had written six books, and of course, we were kind of toying with the idea of, okay, what are we going to do next? We write a lot about the paranormal, unknown anomalies, all that kind of stuff. But what we had really been discussing a lot is how much we love fiction, and is there any truth in it? The myths of Greek and Roman and Norse gods and goddesses. Is there any truth in that? Is there any scientific fact found in those fictional stories? Whether you talk about religious texts or fairy tales or just plain old good novels. And it really kind of took off from there. So we originally had thought of it as sort of the science of story. We wanted to examine that. And it just really sort of exploded into this whole documentation of how from primitive times, not just ancient times, but primitive times, information and ideas have been embedded in stories, in art, in architecture, and how we today are trying to figure out our past based upon those clues.
Larry, why don't you take a stab?
Well, I think Marie covered most of it.
Sorry, Larry.
But no, it's okay. But I'll add also that to me, this was probably one of the most interesting books that we've written. Not to say that all of them have not been fascinating, but this was, I think, particularly interesting in that it combines a lot of the things that Marie and I have both been very interested in for a long time. I mean, we actually had the opportunity with this book to write about extraterrestrials, and we had the opportunity to write about memes and different things that we
Archaeology.
wanted to,
Yeah.
to kind of bring into our writing that we've just not had really the opportunity. We've had to stay so focused on all of our other books. This kind of gave us the opportunity to broaden out somewhat.
Well, let's jump into it. Viral mythology. It seems like today everything goes viral. I mean, you've got a video of a cat and a cute
right.
kid. You've got a water skiing squirrel or some fat guy on a skateboard who falls off, and the video immediately is posted and goes viral. Everything, you know, a guy gives a soundbite to a news crew, and suddenly somebody adds an auto tune to it, and it's
right.
a million people have seen it by the end of the day. In a way, I guess, these are our cave drawings, right?
They are. And unfortunately, as you said, everything goes viral. That's not necessarily the good stuff or the positive stuff or the practical and informative stuff. But there are reasons for that that we explore in the book, why things go viral. And today, it's so easy for the dumbest idea, the dumbest meme to go viral because of technology, because of social networking. And understanding that, Larry and I really wanted to know, well, how did this happen thousands of years ago before they had Facebook, before they had Twitter, before they had YouTube, when nobody was carrying cell phones around and texting and Instagram and all that stuff? How did ideas go viral? But when you look at what's happening today, it really is similar to what happened then, just the means were a little bit different. The end was the same, but the means were different.
Seems to me, Larry, that the fact that everything goes viral means we're a lot less selective about, I mean, in the days when you begin this book and the era when your book begins, when people are sitting around the campfire and telling a story, they're telling their best story. They're not telling every story. They're not telling about the water skiing squirrel. They're talking about the giant saber-toothed tiger that almost ripped their arm off or something like that. Right, Larry, right? More selective?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think also the fact that the folks were so limited in bandwidth in comparison to now. I mean, when you're one-on-one speaking, obviously it's you're reaching a very small audience, and the opportunities for additional facts to creep into the story present themselves probably much, much greater. In other words, if you're telling a story, you're sitting around a campfire, you tell a story, there's four or five folks sitting around the campfire. By the time the same story has reached the fifth person, something in that story will have changed. By the time it gets to the fifth person, there will have been something modified in the story from what the original was. So I think the difference also between then and now is that things probably were a little less accurately portrayed than they are now. Now, it's simply a matter of binary information. You post something on YouTube, you post something on the internet, your message basically stays relatively intact throughout the communication process. In other words, you're not losing any ideas in transit. Now, the folks at the other end, there may be different interpretations of that message, but the base message stays the same.
Take us back to the beginning, Marie. How early humans communicated with each other before we had language, how they told stories, how they passed along myths.
Well, you know, I'm thinking oral tradition is an old way of telling stories, but even before then, probably with a lot of grunts and hand signals. But when we talk about the transmission of information, cave art, whether we're talking about paintings or etchings or carvings on the walls of caves, rock art, so the most crude forms of communication, and it really wasn't art. A lot of it were just scratches and lines, and it meant something to them, and chances are it meant something in terms of what they needed for survival. Some of those scratch marks could have been the number of prey that they saw, or the number of animals that they saw available that they could hunt that day, or what have you. So it was real basic information. Storytelling probably came a little bit later after survival needs were met. But the original cave and rock art did start to get a little more sophisticated, a little more entertaining, where you have scenes of hunting, you have ritual scenes, you have war scenes where you've got men dressed up in warrior gear, you've got images of women who are menstruating and giving birth. And as we evolved as a species, our art became more sophisticated. Therefore, the amount of information that we were able to convey became more sophisticated. We started making ceramic pottery and figurines and statues.
And then we developed mosaic art and paintings and just sort of progressed in sophistication and complexity, which also allowed the message. And that was up to the point where we really were just like children. You know, think about humans now. We start out communicating by drawing pictures. We color, we get our Crayola crayons and our markers out, and we draw pictures. We don't start talking and telling stories until a little later, and then we get into the writing stage. And that's when information just explodes.
Larry, I really enjoyed the chapters about Altamira and those drawings and how humans, we should take it literally about the kinds of images they put on the walls. And I was asking myself, if they painted things they needed for survival and that were of great interest to them, was there porn?
Oh,
wow. Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. It's not something that we've came across in our research.
You know, I think we found something later after we had done the book. I think we both found some, you know, images. I mean, sex and reproduction obviously was important to them.
Yeah.
But it was. I don't think they had like cave, Playboy.
You know, the beginning of the book, you talk about it. It mentions, I think it's the foreword. It's not your stuff, but about how new archaeology is, and it never occurred to me before that the study of this stuff, while the stuff itself that we're studying has been around a long time, the act of studying it is kind of a new process.
Right. Yeah, we're still finding our footing, and you know, there are archaeologists and anthropologists and historians that are all working together. Really, what it's about is uncovering the puzzle pieces to our past without having the box image that you can just look at and say, oh, okay, well, there's what we're trying to create. So we're just uncovering all these pieces. We're not quite sure how they fit together. But the academic study of the past is fairly new, and that kind of fascinated us, too. We thought, wow, it's been around for a long time, hasn't it? I think the interest has, but in a real formal academic sense, it is fairly new.
There's a term that's used by Heather Lynn in the foreword to the book. Larry, maybe you can address it. It's called cosmic cloud computing. Can you explain that and how it sort of relates to the theme of the book?
Well, society today, all of our information now seems to be so disparate from us. It's all, everything is stored in the quote cloud. We all walk around with our different types of iDevices, and all of our information is available at an instant's notice. I mean, everything that we have, your entire life, basically, is stored someplace else. It's stored in the cloud. There's actually a lot of people that believe that as a society, we're somewhat dumbing down as a result, and that information now is so quickly accessible. It's just a matter of pulling out your iPhone or pulling out your Android device or whatever it is that you have, that you don't even need to remember anything. So our brain size and our capacity is actually physically shrinking. But the idea of that is that basically in previous cultures, they did not have that, I guess you could call it a luxury that we have today. The idea being that ancient cultures, everything was written down, and when it was or written down or verbally communicated, and when that information was recorded in such a manner, it was not available to the masses like it is to us. It's easy enough now. We can share our Google calendars with other people, for instance. Back then, technology didn't exist. They didn't have the same ability to share that information so quickly and so readily. And that ability has morphed and changed over time and into what we have today. So I think that term or that concept, I think, really kind of speaks to that. It speaks to the ready availability of information.
Well, and also that there's like a sort of field. And Larry and I wrote a book called The Grid. We feel like it's more like a grid of information that is available. It's almost like Jung's collective unconscious. It's there for anybody to tap into. And we don't really, you can't see this field or this grid, but it is all information and possibly could explain why there are these archaeological enigmas where you have ideas and concepts, whether it's in architecture or art or even storytelling, that showed up at the same time all over the globe, despite the fact that the groups, you know, people were living in a very regional sense. There wasn't air travel. There wasn't a way for them to really communicate those ideas across their own region. So how did all these other groups tap into the same types of information, the same imagery, the same archetypes? So today, I think we forget about all that because, like Larry said, we're so tapped into the information that's right in front of us and easy for us to access via computer. And we're forgetting that there is this more ancient, archetypal, subconscious, collective, whatever you want to call it, grid of information that we probably are engaging in, but I think we're way more distracted now than we were then, so we're probably engaging in it a lot less than we should be.
Well, that's what I was wondering. It's like the equivalent of the Akashic record or something,
right,
a collective memory that we all have. I've often wondered if songwriters, you know, the Beatles, they tapped into something
novelists.
It just flows. It flows out of it.
Yeah. Sure. You know, I've heard famous novelists say, well, I don't write the book. The book is channeled through me from somewhere else. You know, and you also hear about ideas of films that are made at the same time, the same concept. And it's like, wait a minute, you know, we didn't steal it from them. Well, we didn't steal it from them. Well, no, of course not. It is possible that we are tapping into the same ideas at the same time as many other people. And those ideas usually tend to be very universal.
Well, for example, the Golden Rule in the foreword to the book, that's an example that was used as the universality of the Golden Rule. It's the wording is different, but it seems like it's everywhere. How does that work?
Basic moral code that you have to figure in the course of evolution of any group, no matter where they lived in the world, they must have figured out that if you do unto others, you know, they'll do unto you. That sort of reciprocity, the give and take, I think that is just something that was a part of our moral development. And no matter where you lived in the world, that was an obvious way to live. And so that became a very important moral code for different religions, different traditions.
Well, it would be a central question that we're going to come back to a couple of times in the course of the next couple hours, and is whether or not we just all arrived at this conclusion ourselves because it was the right thing to do and it made sense, or whether this kind of information, this kind of code was shared with us by somebody else,
exactly.
Given to us. And looking at your background, the both of you, I guess you're at least open to the idea that maybe somebody did share it with us, that somebody from somewhere else.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, is Golden Rule, is that an example of it, Larry? Would you say somebody gave us a little nudge in that direction?
You know, I think we could certainly, the Golden Rule and pi and really any other type of sacred number. Sure. Why not? I mean, it's certainly possible. I mean, when you start digging and you start looking at some of the more esoteric connections, some of them seem to be a little more than just random happenstance or chance. So I think certainly there's that possibility.
There's a quote in the book from Dr. John Ward. He writes, "Was it the fear of the unknown, one of the greatest power plays that man upon man, to instill within him a fear or dread of the darkness that inhabits a soulless body?" Okay. Which is a great sentence. And I'm just thinking to myself, I imagine this caveman wrapped in fur looking at a dead body, wondering, what happened to him? Why is he different than me?
Yeah. And why is he not moving? Why is he not getting back up? Yeah. So it's possible that even things like the Golden Rule could have, you know, they could have been, these great nuggets of wisdom could have been given to us from extraterrestrials or what have you. But it's possible as well, and we have to cover that, we have to be objective, that we could have learned those lessons naturally and organically by making a lot of mistakes and realizing, hey, you know, if I do this to someone, this is what's going to, it's almost like karma.
Marie Jones, Larry Flaxman are my guests talking about viral mythology, their new book. And when we come back, maybe we'll talk about why pyramids popped up all over the world. Mystical speculation about the nature of reality, the way things really are. And we're exploring some of that same territory tonight with the authors of Viral Mythology. Marie Jones, Larry Flaxman, looking at the history of ideas, how they spread, and the perplexing question about whether or not the nature of how we share information affected our evolution as a species. Good stuff to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Larry, you're here just for this hour, so let me lean on you a little bit. Archaeoenigmas, that's the term you use early in your book, Viral Mythology. What does that mean?
Archaeoenigmas really kind of refers to a subclass artifacts that have been discovered that seem to be out of place or out of time. Throughout archaeohistory, we've discovered a variety of things that just don't seem to quite fit. For instance, we've found what appears to be a spark plug in a piece of coal. We've found watches, obviously things that would not have been invented from pre-Cambrian times in that type of rock sedimentary. Different types of objects that kind of mystify and baffle us how something so ancient could also be so modern. Like I said, there's been a variety of things that have been found. Very interesting things. It's very controversial.
Yeah, what's the name of that? What's the name of that wild device? It's sort of like a sextant or a compass or a.
I'm going to try to pronounce this properly. The Antithicora. Yeah, Antithicora.
Yeah, that is strange. That's really strange.
Yeah.
Do we know what it is?
You know, I think that we do. I think we have a pretty good idea now that it was actually one of the very first primitive navigation computers, even before the sextant. This was something that was way, way more advanced than what cultures had at the time. But it allowed, from the recreations that we've built, we believe that it allowed much more granular navigation information than what the simple sextant provided.
The book traces sort of how the same stories seem to pop up in cultures all over the world. Stories about giants, for example, and fairies, and in mythology. I remember reading mythology as a kid. I loved Greek mythology, and then I moved on to Roman mythology, and I realized, hey, these are the same stories here. It's just different names, but the same characters. And Marie, talk to me about that. I posed the question at the beginning of the program, whether or not we've lost contact with something, whether maybe these things weren't just myths in the sense of being made up or untrue. Maybe there was something really going on that inspired them that we've lost contact with. Address sort of the general question, then we'll get into some specifics.
Oh, absolutely. I've always loved comparative mythology, and it's interesting that there is a field of study revolving around all of the common motifs and themes and symbols that you find, whether it's Norse, Greek, Mesoamerican, Roman mythology. I always like to go back to, or go forward to, today. When we read novels today, we think we're reading fiction. We think everything is completely made up. And yet there is a lot of truth embedded in novels, whether it's personal truth, something the author might have actually gone through, or whether it's something like, I always like to point to The Hunt for Red October as being a really great example of fiction that also includes a lot of factual information. There's theories, there's ideas. There's a lot of truth in our fiction today, which could be considered our myths. So now we go back to the ancient times and the myths that we grew up reading in high school and junior high school, and we have to say to ourselves, was this just pure entertainment? Well, why are there similar gods and goddesses across the board? Why are there motifs like the Green Man that show up in different formats, no matter what region of the world we're talking about? How come everybody has a flood story? And you start to look at all those common themes and think, okay, either we were all experiencing the same thing at the same time, or, you know, we just happen to make stuff up at the same time. I mean, I have a tendency to lean to the former, that people were talking about real historical events, real people. They fictionalized them, no doubt, but the commonalities that you see across the board really speak to a lot of truth and a lot of even scientific knowledge that was embedded in those stories. Well, we can't really deny that.
Well, the flood story, Larry, are we, everyone has a flood story because a flood really happened?
Well, either that, which seems to be astronomical odds that would have occurred for every single society, or the information was somehow passed along. And as I had said previously, about my example of the five different people in the story morphing and changing by the time it hits the fifth person, it may simply be a matter of that, where these traditions and this history were passed on orally. As they're passed on, they change and take on different personifications throughout each cycle. Each person that you talk to adds something different to it. They change something to it, perhaps not intentionally. As it gets passed down, that information kind of organically morphs, and then the different societies and belief systems kind of pick up on that and take that as their true gospel.
You explore this in detail several places in the book about how early humans had trouble passing along the same story. As you mentioned, you pass it on, the story morphs, but some information they pass along because they had to pass it along for the species to survive, and they pass it along without language, without written words, without books. How did they do it? Is there something that they could do that we no longer do?
Symbols, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, before an alphabet came into being, before a written system was evolved, again, we have to go back to visual arts. And one of the most important things that we see are symbols that are very common across the board, you know, no matter what part of the globe you're talking about. Everybody can understand a very basic drawing of a bull attacking a man. One of the symbols I like to talk about that today, so people get a real good idea of what we're talking about here, is we all know the image of a dog. It's like a round sign with a dog on it with a slash through it. And that means no dogs allowed. And that is a way of conveying information in a very basic sense without words. And I think that the cave art, the rock art, a lot of the early glyph art, petroglyphs, they spoke to us in symbols. And we understood what they meant, even though we didn't have somebody standing there and saying, okay, now let me explain to you what this is a symbol of. We just got it. And like you said, I think this is a lost art. I think we are so distracted now by having everything handed to us in terms of having technology at our fingertips that we have lost our understanding of the way symbols speak to the subconscious and how important they are.
I guess what I was asking is, do you think that early humans had some way to convey information without language, without symbols, some way to pass it along mentally or some way to communicate?
Want to go back to that cloud idea, the idea of the collective.
Yeah.
We're real big on that. Now, again, we wrote a whole book called The Grid on this concept of a collective, of a sort of depository, if you will, or like a library of information and ideas that is just out there for people to tap into. But, you know, we can't prove that. Nobody can prove that that exists, except that you go back and you look at the sort of quote-unquote circumstantial evidence that shows groups of people that did not have verbal communication with each other getting the same ideas at the same time, whether it's to build a certain structure that looks exactly the same as the guys 3,000 miles away are building, or their art is the same, their symbols, their writing, their alphabets, whatever. How did they all figure out the same stuff at the same time?
Well, you note in the book, you're quoting Charles Darwin, of all people, about cultural inheritance. He says was learned from one generation to the next via an organic transmission using gemmules. Larry, you want to tackle that one, or is that for Marie?
Well, I think we've kind of hit that with the idea of icons and different types of symbols. I think that really kind of strongly speaks to that concept. Marie, do you have anything else to add?
Where I was going to take it was whether or not it fits into Darwin's larger theme as
right.
Our evolution as a species.
Right, cultural evolution. One of the theories that we looked into, we actually had a wonderful guest contribution by Lorraine Evans on the idea that there is a sort of genetic evolution of ideas, almost a cellular level evolution of ideas, whereby we all of a sudden develop a certain type of art or a certain type of imagery. But it's passed, literally passed down in the DNA. And most people will say that's absolutely impossible. How is it that you could pass an idea down through genetic inheritance? But there's an awful lot of research out there that is showing that this may actually be the case just by looking at the behaviors of, you know, animals. They usually do animal studies, whether they have memory from one generation to another of maybe a trauma that occurred to an earlier generation. Cellular memory, that's another big one. So that's a theory that we had Lorraine write about.
That's what I was asking, whether you think that's true, whether cellular memory you think is true or not. You quote Herbert Spencer in the book, who's the guy that came up with the term survival of the fittest, not Darwin, this guy Spencer, who seems to think that somehow experiences of past generations are imprinted on the human mind and passed along.
I think so. I mean, if you're asking us personally, I do.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know that it's something that can be proven at this point, but I think that the experiences of past generations changes people on a genetic level, and that gets passed down to the next generation. I also remember hearing that trauma. So in other words, 12,000 years ago, when maybe these floods did occur on the Earth, the trauma of survival at the time literally became a part of our genetic makeup. And that might be why that symbol, that flood symbol, is so important to every culture all over the world. So if you're asking personally, yeah, I think we both believe in it. But you know what? Every single theory that we write about has a lot of evidence behind it, almost suggesting that maybe it's a mishmash of all of these theories.
Larry, while we have you for a few minutes, I wonder if you could talk to me about pyramids, that it's such a distinct image that everyone has can put in their minds, and it's a great way to convey sort of a central theme of your book. How we had pyramids, of course, the Egyptian pyramids are the most famous, but as we know, they were in Central America. We know the Bosnians, somebody there built a pyramid that looks like the rest of them. Is that just I don't know, it just doesn't seem like something that should pop into your head that they really needed for some reason to build pyramids. There were a lot of other forms they could have taken. Why did they all take that one and thousands of miles away from each other?
Exactly. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. That is one of the central questions I think that we all have. We don't have the answer to that, but in fact, there are thousands of pyramids that we've found, and probably thousands more that are still undiscovered, but thousands of pyramids throughout the world. So when you think about that at kind of the lower level, how could all of those different cultures and all of those different societies not only have the technological means to build many of those things, but in fact the architecture and the engineering seem to be so similar, and as you said, the shape is very interesting. We don't have an answer. Why did they pick the pyramids, and how did that information get passed along? But I think the fact that particular object was chosen, I think, speaks volumes in itself. Even without understanding exactly why it was, just the fact that there is this unique shape that the cultures have all seemed to kind of revolve around, I think that speaks greatly to the idea of viral mythology, as well as the idea of there being some type of a greater purpose or some type of a more base reason for building these things.
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of an intervention, Marie. The idea
A
that
little help from our friends. Oh,
somebody gives you a
absolutely.
little jolt and says, "Hey, this is a really cool
Sure.
shape. Why don't you
Yeah.
build this?"
Do we have enough
Yeah.
time before break?
Sure. Yeah, we got
That
3 or 4 minutes. Sure.
Yeah. Well, the pyramid is a real basic stable shape. If you think about it, most of your building materials are at the bottom. The heavy weight is at the bottom. And as you get higher, you're using less building materials. So it's a real practical shape geometrically, but also it has a symbolism that could tie into the whole idea of ancient aliens and how this may have been given to us and why. The idea of a pyramid symbolically means that you're starting from a very base foundation. You're moving upwards towards a point of perfection. So you see in the pyramid, you've got the big wide base, and it moves up along the four sides to a point way up in the skies. The bigger the pyramid, obviously. And so the idea again was progressing to a point of perfection from above to, or from below to above. And I think also this is a structure that looks like a triangle, and the triangle is the perfect symbol. It represents the number three, a very powerful symbolic number culturally all over the world.
Well, why? Why
So
is that powerful
exactly,
culturally all over the world?
because the number three represents the unification of duality. So, but did everybody decide that at the same time, though? Like,
Yeah.
hey, we really like the number three. Let's build a
Yeah. Was there a
monument.
conference call or a
Exactly,
Skype or
exactly.
what?
Did they all text each other? Or, as you said, was that given to us from another civilization who came along and said, hey, guys, this is really important. Build these. If you build them, they will come.
Yeah.
Yeah, we get into the ancient alien theory, which is probably the most popular theory behind viral mythology, that we got some help spreading the gospel, spreading the word, spreading these ideas, spreading the information, showing ancient and primitive civilizations, here's how you do it. Being handed the technology to do it.
You mentioned, of course, von Daniken, and how could you not in looking at this stuff? And
Right.
I realize that some things he may have gone too far in some of the examples and or misapplied logic here and there, but it strikes me as a lot of what he says is remains unanswered by mainstream archaeology,
Sure.
and that he's been unfairly treated, just beaten up over the
I
years.
think so, yeah.
Larry, you worry about getting the same kind of treatment?
No, not really, because I think this type of thought and these types of ideas, I think, are becoming a lot more mainstream now. You have to remember, von Daniken has been writing his book since the 60s. So I think the political and the social climate has greatly changed. Things are much more open today. It seems, especially with the internet, there's a lot more open dialogue about these types of mysteries. So I don't worry about that too much. I really think that this is the folks that are questioning our traditional archaeo history now, I think are probably the ones in the future that'll be uncovering a lot of things that we've either overlooked or things that we've simply chosen to ignore.
Well, before I bequeathed PhDs on the two of you, I was thinking that I might ask you about how your fellow academicians might approach this stuff. But I'll just ask you. I mean, both of you couldn't get this theory published in a science journal or an archaeology
Not at
journal.
all. Not at all. No.
The music is telling me we're out of time. Larry's going to be leaving us. Larry Flaxman, thanks very much for joining us. Really enjoyed the book, and I hope you can come back sometime when you can stay longer.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, George. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. We continue our conversation with Marie Jones about their new book, Viral Mythology, right after this.